From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, photographing the human devastation in Somalia, we talk with award-winning photojournalist James Noctway. His haunting pictures of Somalis were published in the New York Times Magazine. Noctway has photographed war and conflict all over the world. Also, we talk with writer Richard Rodriguez. He's been called the Latino writer hardcore leftists love to loathe. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Leonard Cohen's new album, The Future. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council is consulting behind closed doors on a response to Iraq's incursions into Kuwait over the past 2 days. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The U.S. and its allies agree that Iraq must comply with Persian Gulf ceasefire conditions. And it's clear that Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali regards Baghdad's incursions to retrieve weapons as a serious violation and threat to Kuwait. But it's not yet clear how the Security Council will respond or if it will set a deadline. Diplomats say the Council is very concerned about Iraq's motivations, and it is expected to issue a unanimous statement demanding Baghdad's compliance with all resolutions. But the Council's president, Japanese Ambassador Yoshio Hatano, told reporters he does not foresee an immediate use of force by the UN. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The Palestine Liberation Organization said today that the Palestinian delegation will boycott the Mideast peace talks until Israel agrees to the return of more than 400 Arabs who were expelled last month. PLO spokesman Farouk Kaddoumi said today in Cairo that the exiles must be repatriated before the Palestinian delegation will take part in the next round of talks, scheduled for February 20th in Washington. Kaddoumi was attending the latest meeting of Arab League foreign ministers. The exiles are stranded in a tent camp in South Lebanon between territory controlled by Israel and the Lebanese government. Israel accuses them of involvement in Muslim terrorist groups. There's a new chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He's Democratic Congressman Dan Glickman of Kansas, who replaces Dave McCurdy, said to have been forced out of the job. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
McCurdy, who comes from the same moderate wing of the Democratic Party as President-elect Clinton, was hopeful of becoming Secretary of Defense in the new administration. He went so far as to seek support from military officials at the Pentagon, a move that raised the ire of House Democratic leaders who backed Congressman Les Aspin, the eventual nominee. McCurdy also publicly criticized House Speaker Thomas Foley last year during the House bank scandal and suggested to other Democrats that he be replaced as Speaker. Foley yesterday denied there was an element of retribution in his decision to replace McCurdy as Intelligence Committee chair. Still, that's the message many on Capitol Hill are getting. Glickman has served on the intelligence panel since 1987. He believes U.S. intelligence operations should be refocused on economic issues instead of military and political affairs. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, boosted by gains at IBM and Eastman Kodak companies. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close at 3,263. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. In Geneva today, international mediators have given the Bosnian Serbs one more day to decide whether to accept a plan that would preserve Bosnia as a unified state. The Serbs had been pressing for a separate state in Bosnia, but Serbian leader Radovan Karadzic apparently dropped that demand today. Half of all Americans who currently have AIDS are either black or Hispanic, and while the number of new AIDS cases among whites actually fell between 1990 and 1991, it continued to climb in blacks and Hispanics. The disparity is the focus of a report on minorities and AIDS released today by the National Commission on AIDS. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The commission said the government isn't doing enough to reach minority communities and even smaller groups within those communities, say, black homosexuals or Hispanic IV drug users. To put the message out, abstain from sex or use condoms, don't share needles, requires different language for the different groups. Specifically, the commission would like to see more money for local groups to produce ads and information programs using the language of the community. And commissioners called for full funding for the Ryan White Care Act, which channels money for prevention and treatment to the nation's hardest-hit cities. So far, Congress has appropriated $351 million of the $880 million called for by the bill. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The U.S. Coast Guard returned more than 200 Haitian refugees to Port-au-Prince today. The refugees who were repatriated were taken into custody on Saturday after a Coast Guard helicopter reported spotting them in a dangerously overloaded sailboat. A Coast Guard spokeswoman said officials are also looking for information on a missing vessel. Cuban officials first reported that they rescued 8 Haitians just before Christmas and quoted the refugees as saying their vessel had gone down with about 396 people on board. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you ever wonder about the power of photojournalism, look at Somalia. Americans supported military intervention there in part because they were so moved by the pictures of famine victims. Some of the most powerful pictures I've seen from Somalia were taken by my guest, James Noctway. The New York Times Magazine published them in a photo essay last month. One picture showed an emaciated, dead body on a dirty linoleum floor. Two men are preparing the body for burial by washing it with water from a rusty kettle. The corpse's eyes are open and seem to be looking blankly into the camera. For about a decade, James Noctway has been putting himself in harm's way to take pictures. He's photographed conflicts in Central America, Lebanon, the Philippines, Korea, Sri Lanka, Israel's occupied territories, and Northern Ireland. He spent most of last year in South Africa. He's a 3-time winner of the Robert Capa Gold Medal, honoring photographic reporting from abroad, requiring exceptional courage and enterprise. I asked him why he went to Somalia.
The first big news barrage had already happened by the time I was able to go, and I thought, well, maybe I should just send a check to one of the relief organizations, and somehow that didn't seem to be the proper response. It seemed to be a little distant, and I realized that I'm a photographer, and I get involved in the world through my work, and that is how I should make my contribution, so that with or without an assignment from a magazine, I felt compelled to go there and become involved as a photographer and let my pictures speak however they might and through whatever channels they might find. So I, on my own, went there.
Another photograph I just want to try to describe. It's of a woman being transported to from a hospital to a feeding center. She's in a wheelbarrow.
Yes.
And she looks near death because she's very emaciated. Her hand is being held palm up, almost as if she was asking something for something, although I doubt that she was. But there's something so disturbing about seeing a person in a wheelbarrow that looks pretty filthy, as if it were used not too long ago to transport dirt or fruit or something, you know, but something that left it dirty, and it doesn't look like a person belongs in there. It's like the person has been very objectified by being in there. There's also something very otherworldly about the photo. I think that's in part because the woman is so sick. I think it's in part because of the context of her being in a wheelbarrow. And I think it's in part because of the lighting that you got. Tell me about taking that photograph.
Well, there is something strange about seeing a human being transported in a wheelbarrow, because it's not what wheelbarrows are for. And I think it underlines the desperation of that situation. And perhaps that's what, you know, viewers sense when they look at it. And it is an added element of horror, not only concerning her physical state, but the means of transporting her itself that underlines that horror. The people there had so few resources of any kind that this wheelbarrow happened to have been donated by UNICEF, I suppose as part of one of their development projects, perhaps to help them dig irrigation ditches or whatever. And the situation had turned so bad that these implements that had been donated by foreign relief agencies were now being used to transport people.
Why did you take these pictures in black and white?
It was my choice. The fact that I went without any assignment or without any backing from a publication meant that I was very free to choose whatever I wanted to do outside of the requirements of any specific publication. And I just felt that black and white would distill the essence of this tragedy in a more powerful way than color might. That color might be a bit distracting, whereas black and white would, I think, help viewers to really concentrate on the essence of the story, which was, as far as I was concerned, human suffering.
I think the pictures in print and the images we saw on TV from Somalia had a huge effect in mobilizing American support for intervention there. Did Somalia seem to you like a triumph of photojournalism?
I think that in a way it was, and in another way it wasn't, not only for photojournalism, but just for the press as a whole, which includes photography, television, print, and radio. I think that the contribution made by all of the press was instrumental in getting aid there in the first place, and then in prompting President Bush and sending troops. I think in that sense, it really highlights the fact that the press can and does have an immediate effect on different situations in the world. I think that where it didn't fulfill its full potential is the fact that I think the coverage came too late, and that the troops were sent too late, and that most of the aid was sent too late. I think outside of the ICRC, which was there very early on, and I think trying to make people aware of what was going on, everyone else was just too late. A lot more lives could have been saved. The situation could have been ameliorated much sooner.
I wonder if you worry about oversaturation, if you worry that there's a point where viewers start to look at starving people and think, well, oh, we saw that already.
I don't believe in that. I think that people, we have all seen starving people. I mean, for years and years, we've been seeing starvation in Africa. And every time the press mobilizes, there's a response from the public. I think that that the so-called compassion fatigue is, there may be some truth to it, but I think it's really selling people short, because if people are presented with a situation like that, it seems to me they always respond. And I think it's just human nature, and that it's a reflection of the best in human nature, and we should never forget that. That if there's a tragedy in the world that needs attention, that needs the help of the world community, we cannot say, oh, let's not do it because people won't care. We have to believe that people will care, and I think that time and time again it's been proven that people do care and they will respond.
Photojournalist James Noctwe is my guest. When you went to Somalia, you went there freelance. You didn't have an institution behind you.
Right.
What are the hazards of going into a situation like that without, you know, a set of editors and so on back home to back you up?
Right. There are certainly hazards involved in that. If you get hurt, which could have happened there, I mean, it's definitely a dangerous situation and unpredictable, and anything can happen to someone who goes there. You're on your own. I mean, there's no one to, you know, pay for a medevac. There's no one to pay your health insurance or to look after you. You're basically on your own, and you're at your own risk. And just... I mean, that's probably the greatest involved. Another risk is just of a lesser degree, but somewhat important, is the financial risk. You have to go into your own bank account, you have to buy your plane ticket, and you have to pay for all your expenses, which in this case were quite sizable, without ever having an assurance that it's going to come back to you. Yeah, I mean, you're risking your own financial resources and your own time and your own health.
Well, I know you got sick in Somalia. What happened to you, and when did you start realizing that you were sick?
Well, I made two trips to Somalia. The pictures which were published in the New York Times were made in late September and early October, and on that trip I got an amoebic parasite, which wasn't that difficult to deal with, and I've gotten them before in different parts of the world. It can be hazardous, but if it's caught in time, it can be dealt with. It's not very pleasant, but it can be dealt with and eliminated. I made another trip in November for a French newspaper, and I also got a parasite on that trip, but much more devastating was a case of dengue fever, which landed me in the hospital for 5 days, and from which I'm still feeling the effects. It's a kind of virus that's transmitted by a mosquito. It's not contagious, and it does not recur, but while you have it, it's very devastating, extremely painful, and I'm still recovering from that.
Do you have any idea why you do what you do, why you travel from one war to another, from one famine to another, taking pictures?
I think at this point, what becomes the enduring reason for it is to be of use. As I was saying earlier in regard to what is called compassion fatigue, I think that people will respond to the press. They'll respond to images. They'll respond to television broadcasts. If it's brought to them in a strong and compassionate way, and I just think that's what my job has become. I think earlier in anyone's career, a lot of other factors come into play. You know, just your natural curiosity, which I think is a prerequisite for being a journalist in the first place. In my case, I wanted to test myself in certain situations. I just wanted to see what things were. I wanted to educate myself. And all of those are important, much more important earlier on, and they kind of wear away. And in the end, the enduring reason and really what's left for me is just wanting to be useful.
My guest is photojournalist James Noctway. His photo essay on Somalia was published last month in the New York Times Magazine. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Photojournalist James Noctway is my guest. I want to go back to a photo from 1984 that's printed in your book, Deeds of War. And this is from the San Miguel province in El Salvador. There were troops that were ambushed by rebels, and there were casualties waiting for an evacuation helicopter. In the foreground, a father is shielding his wounded young daughter with his own body. She was probably wounded in the crossfire. It's not only a very moving shot, it's a beautifully composed shot. I'm wondering where you were when you took this, what you were doing there, and where were you during the fighting that seemed to have happened just minutes before the photo was taken?
I had been, I had joined an army patrol the night before, and I just walked with them in the mountains. They were looking for rebels to make contact with the rebels. And in the at the very break of dawn, this patrol was ambushed. And I was with them when they got ambushed. The bullets were hitting the ground at my feet along with the soldiers. And I survived the first few minutes and found cover, and then just operated, photographing the soldiers as they fought and maneuvered, and eventually got to a point which had been designated a landing zone to take away the wounded. And this campesino father and child were there, waiting to be picked up by a helicopter along with some wounded soldiers. And shots continued to be fired, and at one point the man shielded his daughter with his own body. And to me, this was an act of heroism. I mean, a man was willing to sacrifice himself for his child. And it's perhaps what any father would do for his child. And here was this anonymous campesino, I think, performing an act of heroism, and I was there to record it. And I think that's really a lot of what happens in the world are these tremendously heroic acts performed by ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And I think that in war, it's a situation where things happen that don't happen anywhere else. And I guess those are the kind of things I try to record. Those are the human moments that are of most interest to me.
What is the greatest risk you've ever taken for any one picture?
I don't know if I can answer that exactly that way. I think that there have been many situations where I've been at risk, and that you know, members of the press in general put themselves at risk. I mean, if you just go to a war zone, you're at risk because it's so unpredictable. And people with a lot more experience at war and with a lot more training at war are getting killed and wounded all around you. It doesn't take you very long to understand that it can just as well be happening to you. And I think it's a decision that you really have to come to grips with and be at peace with very early on, because you never want to find yourself in a situation and go, why did I do this? I think you should know why you're doing it before you go and have that very clear in your mind, because that's what gets you through. That's enables you to do your job if you have a sense of why you're there. I think that carries you through all the obstacles.
When you say that you have to be at peace with this, do you go so far before an assignment to say to yourself, getting these pictures is worth losing my life if necessary?
I think you have to understand that that can happen to you. I think you're a fool if you go to a war and don't realize that you can be killed or very badly injured, that your life can be changed very dramatically in a split second. If you go into a war without realizing that, you're really being foolish, and you probably shouldn't go.
Have you found that you were in some places where your work as a photojournalist has been really respected, and other places where you've been considered the enemy, where you've become a target?
I think that journalists are easy targets. First of all, we don't carry weapons, and we, especially people involved with cameras, either video or still cameras, are kind of, you know, looking through their camera, and they're not seeing what's behind them, and they're very concentrated on making an image, and therefore very vulnerable to, you know, either being attacked by rioters or being shot, because we are intent on using our cameras, so we're easy targets.
Your book of photographs from 1989 is dedicated in part for all those who helped a stranger and asked for nothing in return. I imagine you're referring to a lot of people who helped you and asked for nothing in return. Can you tell us about one of those people and one of the things that they did for you?
1986, I went to do a story in the Jaffna Peninsula of Sri Lanka about the Tamils and what was happening between the Tamils and the Sinhalese in Sri Lanka. And I got caught in an attack on the rebel base I was in. And it was clear to me that we were surrounded and that this location was going to be overtaken and that I should do my best to get out of there. So I made an escape and hid out nearby in someone's house. And these people didn't know me. I mean, I was the only foreigner on all of Jaffna Peninsula, and I must have looked very strange to them, showing up in the middle of the night during a big battle. And they must have been very frightened in the first place that the battle was taking place and that I was knocking on their door in the middle of the night in the second place. And they took me in and allowed me to stay there and take refuge in their house. I suppose not knowing what repercussions might come down on them because of it, but they were generous enough to take in a stranger, and they were obviously going to get nothing out of it. And I mean, things like that have happened many times, and I guess it was just my way of, you know, paying my respects to those very brave and generous people.
Do you envision a time when you'd want to stop doing what you're doing?
I don't. Not really. I mean, I realize that sooner or later that day might come, but it hasn't come yet. I feel that at this point I'm very experienced. I know how to go about doing what I do, and I feel that because of that I'm probably more useful now than I ever was, and that there's really no reason to stop. But on the contrary, there's every reason to continue.
Do you think you could live in the United States and be happy here now?
You mean to just not travel anymore?
Yeah, to not travel anymore. And frankly, do you think you'd be happy living in a place that wasn't at war?
I do live here.
But you're not home very much.
No, I'm not.
But I mean, you've become so accustomed to being in the middle of catastrophe.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I'm addicted to it. I think I do it for a reason. I don't particularly like it. In fact, part of me didn't want to go to Somalia at all because I knew I had an idea what I was going to see, and I didn't particularly want to subject myself to it. I didn't want to face the danger and the risk of sickness and the discomfort that I knew was there. I know enough about it now. I know exactly what I'm going to face, and part of me just didn't want to deal with it at all. And I think my better self overcame that, and I went and did my job. But I'm not addicted to those situations. I don't even particularly like them, but I feel a certain compulsion to communicate those situations.
Well, I wish you very good luck, and I thank you for taking out a little bit of time to talk with us.
Thank you.
James Nachtwey. Some of his pictures are published in his 1989 book, Deeds of War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Richard Rodriguez is a Mexican-American writer who has been criticized for identifying most with the American side of his background. Coming up, a talk with Rodriguez about the myth of multiculturalism, the errors of affirmative action, and finding a community to feel part of. Rodriguez has a new book of essays about his dual heritage called Days of Obligation. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Leonard Cohen's new album, The Future. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has voted to condemn Iraqi incursions into Kuwait over the last 2 days. The statement warned of what were termed serious consequences if Iraq continues to defy terms of the Persian Gulf ceasefire. While the council told Baghdad to return any missiles that had been seized, it called for no punitive measures in addition to those already in place. White House officials have accused Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein of trying to cheat wherever possible on Persian Gulf ceasefire terms. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
Last week, Iraq challenged the UN by placing anti-aircraft missiles in the no-fly zone of southern Iraq. Now the U.S. says Iraq is challenging the UN on three new fronts. In the north, they say Iraq continues to harass relief shipments to the Kurds. Second, UN officials have now been banned from using their own aircraft to fly in and around Iraq. The third violation occurred on Sunday, barely 24 hours after the missile issue had been resolved. 200 Iraqis crossed over into Kuwait, carrying off weapons Iraqi forces had been forced to abandon at the end of the Gulf War. The UN protested. Today, Iraqis returned to plunder some more. U.S. officials are calling these violations as serious as the confrontation caused by the missiles. Then the U.S. and its allies demanded compliance or appropriate military action. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A spokesman for President-elect Bill Clinton says that Clinton stands four square with the Bush administration's policy of not allowing Iraq to violate U.N. sanctions. Bill Clinton wrestled with health care issues today, another one of the increasingly difficult problems that are piling up on his agenda as he prepares to take over the reins of government. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Little Rock.
In Little Rock today, Clinton met with his health care advisors and members of his future Treasury, Budget, and Health and Human Service departments. It was his first briefing on health care reform since Election Day. During the campaign, Clinton promised to make basic health insurance available to all Americans and at the same time control the cost of medical care. Universal access is expensive and a more difficult proposition in light of the new higher deficit figures Clinton's advisors have been discussing. Today, Clinton spokesman George Stephanopoulos said Clinton's team still must figure out a way to phase in access for the uninsured and determine the scope of a basic benefits package. Other aides say Clinton's advisors have considered a wide range of options for controlling costs, from immediately freezing all health care costs at the rate of inflation to tackling the problem piecemeal with efforts to control the cost of prescription drugs. In Little Rock, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 11 points to close at 3,262.75 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Bosnia, officials are considering sending in supplies by airlifts to a town in the eastern part of the nation where hundreds of people are said to be dying. Airdrops have not been used before because of the possibility of low-flying planes being shot down. But a top-level UN official said that he supports the move if reports that civilians are dying from cold and starvation turn out to be true. Roads to the town are covered with snow, and there is the possibility that some roads may be mined. There are said to be some 20,000 refugees in the town that is usually home to only 8,000 people. And some refugees are said to be living in caves and huts in the woods. California Democrat Leon Panetta was on Capitol Hill again today, this time as President-elect Bill Clinton's choice to head the Office of Management and Budget. At confirmation hearings today, Panetta was asked how he would tackle the federal budget deficit. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Panetta was asked by members of the Senate Governmental Operations Committee whether President-elect Clinton is sticking to his promise of cutting the federal budget deficit in half over the next 4 years. That task is expected to be more difficult now in light of figures released by the Bush administration last week showing that the deficit is projected to be much larger than earlier expected. Panetta said that no government spending programs are exempt from possible budget cuts, and Panetta suggested that reducing the deficit may now be a higher priority than Clinton's promised middle-income tax cut. As chairman of the House Budget Committee, Panetta enjoyed a reputation as a vocal advocate for a pay-as-you-go approach to the federal budget. And if confirmed as Bill Clinton's budget director, as he most certainly will, Panetta will likely play the role of deficit hawk. Democratic Senator James Sasser said that Panetta is embarking on the toughest job in Washington. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
In trading in Europe today, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Richard Rodriguez has described himself as a comic victim of two cultures, Mexican and American. But in a time when preserving ethnic identity is emphasized, Rodriguez speaks with pride about assimilation. His parents are Mexican. He grew up in California. You may know him as an essayist for the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. In his 1982 autobiography, Hunger of Memory, Rodriguez wrote about his reservations over bilingual education and affirmative action. He was criticized for identifying more with his American than Mexican heritage. In his new book, Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father, Rodriguez returns to Mexico, considers his Mexican identity, and rethinks some of the positions from his first book. Immigrants and their children often worry about losing their cultural identity, but Rodriguez says it is self-destructive to protect your identity by limiting what you learn and expose yourself to.
When I talk to Hispanic young people, I always tell them, of course, you know, don't listen to people who tell you, you know, that you're losing your culture. For one thing, culture is not a suitcase or not a thing. It is not something static. Do not expect to have the culture of your parents. You know, I am not my father. He grew up in the state of Colima in western Mexico. The notion that I have lost his culture is, of course, inevitable. And uninteresting to say. The fact is that my culture is Lucille Ball, my culture is Walt Disney, my culture is Black America, is rap groups, is my culture is Martin Luther King Jr. The notion that you lose your culture, I think, is one that freezes time and makes children afraid of the inevitability of their adulthood.
You received an excellent education first in Catholic schools, and then you went to several universities for a BA and then graduate work, you know, with the help of scholarships. After college, you applied to teach at several universities, and you not only got a lot of teaching offers, you got offers with a lot of incentives to take those offers. But you ended up withdrawing your application from all the universities who made you offers. Why did you withdraw your application?
Call it white guilt. It turned out that Richard Rodriguez, when he started hearing himself described as a minority student, finally couldn't reconcile how his own movement into the middle class through education justified these benefits. And the scene I describe in my first book, Hunger of Memory, of being in Wheeler Hall in Berkeley one afternoon when a Jewish graduate student who was not getting job offers said to me, you know, once upon a time my grandfather applied to Harvard and was kept out because he was Jewish, and now I'm kept out of Harvard because I'm not Mexican. I had no answer to him. I also had no answer to those Mexicans who by their silence haunted me around the university, the gardeners, the janitors, the people one would see in cafeterias. Those people who, by their very exclusion from the institution, made me numerically a minority within the institution. How exactly was my presence, was my advancement related to their situation? More to the point, as America was busy in the last 20 years creating this artificial brown and black bourgeoisie, how exactly was our advancement related to the so-called inner city or to our home communities?
Okay, so you would have felt guilty accepting the positions because you thought you were being hired in a kind of affirmative action way.
Well, quite clearly, Terry. I mean, I was getting job offers at a time in which if you were white and you were male, there were no job offers.
Right.
And I was getting them unsolicited from places like Yale University, where you normally do not get unsolicited job offers.
Right.
And there was an easy ascendancy to all of this. I mean, you can tell me that I was talented, But I know my talent, and I probably belonged at a large state university somewhere, given a more equitable situation. The fact is that I was being propelled into the stratosphere at a point in my life when I simply couldn't justify that movement.
Is there anything inherently wrong with the impulse to keep university faculty multicultural, to have it be representative of different ethnic groups in America?
Well, I mean, first of all, that notion of multiculturalism seems to me to be either, what shall I say? I mean, there is no multiculturalism in America. There is a culture in America which likes the idea of multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is a culturally biased term. It derives from some Canadian model of the I, the first-person pronoun. The notion in America, this Protestant notion that we have, we are, after all, a Protestant culture, that the most interesting thing about us is the fact that we are not one another. What I was struck with quite early, of course, is that there is an America here. Americans walk the same way. They are impatient at the fast food counter in quite the same way. They have the same kind of slouch. They all sound the same. And yet they all go on about multiculturalism. And there is not an American politician who would sit at this microphone and would tell you anything else except the fact that we are made better as a nation because we are diverse, that you are not me. Well, I have come here as a Mexican Catholic to tell you that, in fact, I am you. I'm Irish. I am Chinese. I live in a Chinese city right now, and I'm breathing their air, and they are changing me, and it is inevitable. You know what people say about dogs? If you get a dog, you better be careful what he looks like, because you're going to look like him after a while.
I appreciate what you're saying, but on the other hand, I mean, I think, like, for instance, any woman art student will tell you about the pressures she was under when she was one of the few women in the art class, and all the teachers were men. I know a lot of, you know, African American students feel like people don't quite get certain things that they feel when all the faculty members that they have are white. I mean, there is a certain amount of shared experience that you don't have with people who are of a different color or a different gender.
At the deepest level, you and I are not the same. I look into your eyes. You are my daughter. You are my mother. And I realize that there is an enormous gulf between us. Multiculturalism, if it is saying that about us, that we are finally isolated within the cell of our humanity, then I believe you. If you are telling me that by virtue of my Catholicism, by virtue of the fact that I'm homosexual, by virtue of the fact that I live in California, that I am different from you, by virtue of the fact that I'm male, et cetera, I'm arguing that as an American, that is within the notion of my Americanness, that I belong to some larger narrative that connects me to you. And that is the business of education to teach me. The other day I was in Las Vegas talking to some high school educators, and there was this school principal who came up to me after the talk. It was in one of these grotesque ballrooms. I think it was called a Versailles ballroom. And he came up and he slapped me in the back afterwards. He said, you know, great talk, Dick, he said. He said, and this with a kind of note of congratulations in his voice, he said, you know, we don't have any white or black students in our school anymore. He said, we have only Asians and blacks, Asian and Hispanics. It has changed so radically in the last 10 or 15 years, he says. This is in the Southwest. And he says, you know, we don't have Black History Week anymore. We have Newcomers Month now. And I thought to myself, this is ludicrous. This is ludicrous. The notion that a Vietnamese child does not need to know the story of Black Americans, the notion that a Vietnamese or a Guatemalan child does not participate by virtue of being an American in that story is wrong, it seems to me, and trivializes both the experience of the Vietnamese child and his need to make sense of his Americanization.
My guest is Richard Rodriguez, and he's written a new book called Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Richard Rodriguez is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Days of Obligation, and of a previous book called Hunger of Memory. You may also know him as an essayist for the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. When you were in college, there was a dean who said to you that he was certain after graduation you'd be able to work among your people. What did that mean to you? When you think back on that, what does it mean to you now?
Well, I mean, what he meant, of course, is go back to East L.A. or wherever he thought I came from. In fact, my mother was very ambitious for our lives. and moved into a relatively white middle-class area of Sacramento, California, which is where I grew up. They are my people. And I stand, like you, in a classroom of inner-city kids as impressed as you would be by how little I can say, how different our experiences are, how different they are from me. I feel, frankly, easier in Mexico with the Mexican poor than I do with the American poor.
Why is that?
I don't know why, except that in some way, you know, that the Mexican poor remind me. I mean, normally they're my own family members, they are cousins and relatives, and there is not in Mexico that same sense that poverty distinguishes human beings, because Mexico doesn't read identity quite as economically as America does. You know, America is a country where we ask each other what we do for a living before we ask each other our family names. Mexico is a country that asks about family names.
I know that you don't feel that, you know, you represent the Mexican-American community, that you can be a spokesperson for, that they are your people and you are their role model. I want to ask you about another community and how connected or not you feel to it, and that's the quote gay community. I'm putting that in quotes only because there's no one community. But
well, I put it in quotes too. I always tell people that I'm not gay, that I'm morose.
But do you feel part of that quote community? Do you know, or do you still have the same feeling that I am an individual? I speak for myself.
Well, you know, and it's curious that you phrase it in that way, because although I have been criticized in my writing for being this from the same people who would go on and on about being multicultural, by the way, that I'm too Catholic, that I'm too guilt-ridden, and that I'm too solemn in my homosexuality, that I should be, as the word says, more gay. In fact, you know, one of the interesting things that I saw in this city when I came back to San Francisco in the late 1970s was, of course, this extraordinary explosion of leisure and freedom and play that characterized the gay movement of the 1970s in San Francisco, the Castro District. And there I was, the skeptical gray man, even then in my 20s. What happened in San Francisco when the virus began in the 1980s to take friends of mine was, of course, that the culture was changed, and in some deep way, the American brashness of that first gay generation in this city, those people who'd come from Scotland and those people who'd come from Brooklyn and from Kansas to become someone new in California, they've had to face tragedy. The interesting thing was, of course, that within the tragic culture, there emerged a true community. There was the realization that we form a we. I'm caring for you. I promise you I will be here when you need me. I promise I will hold your hand when you die. There was a sense that we belong to each other, and there is now in San Francisco, at a time when so-called gay men and women are criticized by politicians for undermining family values. They are, in fact, the people who have the strongest family values that I know of in this city. A friend of mine, a woman who's just divorced, says, you know, the only happily married couples I know are all gay. And I know what she speaks of. She speaks of a friend of mine who nurses another friend of mine, these two men who are dying, though at different stages of the disease. And he bends over to kiss his lover, but realizes that his lover's face is so scarred that he has nowhere to plant his lips without harming his lover. And so he kisses his lover by brushing his eyelashes against his face. And I think to myself, nothing in the Brownings, nothing in the Romantics has taught me this kind of love, has taught me to watch the death of the young, nursing the young as they move toward death.
I know that you feel very deeply about your Catholicism. How do you feel that how do you deal with the fact that the Catholic Church really has not responded very positively to homosexuals? How do you reconcile that?
Well, when you say the church, you must realize that for those of us within the church is not so much a monolith. The church is my mother. The church is this wonderful Jesuit priest who's one of my best friends, who makes this strange appearance in the book and leads me to the head of Joaquin Murrieta in Santa Rosa one summer afternoon.
So you can practice whether or not what the Pope has to say.
Well, I do as a Catholic, and here I admit to the Protestant influence in my life. I exist now as a Catholic within a culture of I do rely on conscience a great deal, much more than the Pope of Rome would like me to assert. but I remain comfortable within the church. I also remain, as I think the church also must recognize, a prophetic presence. That is, I think that the church is primitive in its understanding of sexuality, not simply homosexuality, but in its understanding of the married life. And I think in some sense that the lay community is a prophetic presence leading the church forward. We are not simply led by the clergy, quite clearly. I like all of those stories. The most brilliant one in my own life, the story of the Virgin Mary appearing as an Indian in Mexico to an Indian in 1531. I like the notion that she sends this Indian, Juan Diego, off to the Spanish bishop to convince him, basically to convert the Spaniard to her reality, that she appears as an Aztec. There are these stories throughout the history of the church of the clergy as being the last ones to get the point, as being the ones who need to be converted by the 12-year-old girl. And the church tells these stories on herself. And in that sense, I remain a Catholic. They cannot take it away from me. It is too much a part of my life. And to be a Catholic is really to belong to a tradition, to a community that does not simply rely on my ability to decide to be a part of or not to be a part of. As the old saying goes, once a Catholic, which is to say, I don't simply live within a Protestant possibility of saying, well, I reject all that. I mean, it's not simply mine to reject. It has embraced me. It has created me. And in some basic way, the great tension in my life is not ethnic but religious. I'm a Catholic, a Mexican Catholic, in a secular Protestant country. The tensions that produces for me are much more rigorous at this moment than the tensions of ethnicity.
Well, Richard Rodriguez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Rodriguez has a new book called Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Terry. We'll have news today of the Iraqi move across the border into Kuwait, where some Iraqis went over and removed things from inside a warehouse across what is to be the new border between Iraq and Kuwait, what that means. We'll also be hearing about the Geneva talks trying to arrange peace in Bosnia and elsewhere in the former Yugoslavia. A talk with the sports editor of USA Today about that paper's follow-up on the athletes who made their high school All-American football team 10 years ago, and Noah Adams reports on the Stickley or Mission furniture, not so much a style of design as a way of life.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Leonard Cohen is one of the moodiest singer-songwriters who emerged in the 60s. His best-known song is Suzanne. Ken Tucker has a review of Cohen's new album, The Future.
Are you back in my life to stay? Or is it just for today? Or that you're gonna need me? If it's a thrill you're looking for, honey, I'm flexible.
I spent my teenage years sneering at Leonard Cohen, dismissing his overwrought poetry set to music as, well, as poetry set to music. In my conception of pop artistry, any attempt to bring poetry's high culture into the dank, tattered halls of rock and roll was a sacrilege. Does anyone besides me remember the days when Middlebrow magazines actually used to run pieces arguing over who was the better poet, John Keats or Bob Dylan? Leonard Cohen was a published poet and novelist who emerged from Canada in the 60s. It was only because our ears had become accustomed to the cracked, vinegary whine of Dylan that we could accept Cohen's solemn croaking as a musical instrument. Unlike Dylan, Cohen never became a big star, but his cult influence has endured, inspiring many post-punk depressives that they too could be pop stars. And Cohen, who's now 58, has also outlasted my dismissiveness, or maybe I've grown into his idea of poetry. In any case, The Future, like his previous album, 1988's I'm Your Man, strikes me as a downbeat doozy.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. this order from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
In the 60s, Cohen's work was a model of romantic sincerity and therefore rather a bore. As he's grown older, however, he's become more fatalistic, more anarchic, more horny. The song I just played, Democracy, is an aging Canadian's critique of our American way of life, as he says, the cradle of the best and of the worst. In the middle of the tune that began this review, Be For Real, Cohen breaks off singing to mutter lasciviously, I don't give a damn about the truth, baby, except the naked truth. And the title song of the album is a bit of delirious nihilism in which Cohen demands that the future give him, and I quote, crack and anal sex. I've seen the future, brother, he says, and it's murder. It's as if Cohen has been shaken out of a 30-year poetic sleep to find that the world is a mess, and in his own lugubrious way, he's having a post-midlife freakout. Yet in the midst of all this, he can also summon up the humor and spirit to offer this beautifully idiosyncratic version of Irving Berlin's Always.
I'll be loving you. With a love that's true, always. When the thing you've planned needs my helping hand, I will understand always.
There are a few times on this album when I still feel like sneering at Leonard Cohen, when he strikes me as little more than Barry White with an appreciation of William Blake and the Marquis de Sade. But most of the time, his melancholy dolorousness is strikingly timely, comforting even. What can I say? I've heard the future, and its name is Leonard Cohen.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Not for just a second or a minute or an hour. Not for just the weekend and a shake down in the shower. Not for just the summer and the winter going sour. But always, always.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Thad Kirk, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Next week, Bill Clinton becomes the first Democrat in the White House since Jimmy Carter. And what does Jimmy Carter think of that? We'll ask him on the next Fresh Air. Carter has written a new memoir about his first political campaign. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.